Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hi, I'm Nick Ravelis, the Geisel Director of Education and Outreach for San Diego Opera. As you know, we have a number of opportunities for you to get to know opera and our current season by tuning in here to UCSD-TV. One of our most exciting offerings is Stars in the Salon. This series is an opportunity for you, our audience, to meet the singers, the conductors, and the stage directors who create our productions. Taped before a live audience, the artists discuss their roles, the music, and the stories behind the operas. It's especially entertaining and informative for those of you who are new to opera. Join us now for Stars in the Salon, and I'll see you at the opera. Welcome to this Stars in the Salon, this Artists' Roundtable, concerning our first production of the international season 2012. We've made it thus far, and we're still going strong. We're really delighted to have you all here. It shows an intense interest in this wonderful opera that we haven't seen actually here at San Diego Opera since 1998. Some of you may remember that production. It was actually the first season that I started full-time with San Diego Opera. I remember it fondly, and I've been waiting for it ever since. Now we'll have to get on to Electra. Don't you agree?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'll do it.
So, first of all, I would like to introduce the artists that have joined me. Oh, and before I do that, I want to announce that this season, The Stars in the Salon, is sponsored by a generous grant from Holland America Line. Let's thank Holland America for that. And without their support, this would really not be possible. And without your support, so many things that we do in terms of outreach wouldn't be possible. So thank you. Thank you all who give money, who donate time, treasure, and interest to this great art form. So I'm going to skip over Ms. Lindstrom for the moment. She's on her way. Next to her on the table was with us last production of Benjamin Britten's Peter Grimes, as the conductor of that production, Stuart Bedford. Next to him, our stage director making his San Diego Opera debut, Sean Curran. Next to him, Helden tenor who has not been with us since Boris Godunov, and that's got to be six or seven seasons ago, tenor Alan Glassman as Herod. And finally, over there on the end, bass baritone singing the role of Yochanaan, Greer Grimsley. All right, now I'd like to start out a little unusually. Some of you are familiar with the quote by this critic concerning Puccini's Tosca. He called Tosca a shabby little shocker. And I thought, well, if he called Tosca a shabby little shocker, I wonder what he has to say about Strauss's Salome. This is a little lengthy, but not too, I think you'll find this fun. Salome, Yochanaan, Herod, and Herodias are as unreal as the less laboriously etched figures in Turandot. For only some kind of sympathy or interest on the part of the composer could make them live. This was not forthcoming. And so the sensational action is, in the deepest sense, irrelevant. Strauss probably intended the piece as an abstract display of sexual perversion, and as such, it has been admired by some critics, obviously not him. But I find no reality on this plane either. Consistency, power, unity, ingenuity, yes.
The overloading of detail is not as tedious as in other Strauss operas, and the whole is bound together with the greatest skill in a form comparable to that of a symphonic poem. The musical progress comes to its triumphant conclusion on the very last page in a very famous, very loud passage, which carries harmonic audacity farther than ever before. In musical technique, masterly. In sentiment, the most banal sound in the whole opera. John the Baptist's severed head might as well be made of marzipan. And here's the kicker. And it is for this sugary orgasm that all the fantastically involved aphrodisiac machinery has been required. That's Joseph Kerman in the book Opera as Drama, which you have to understand was published in 1952. I wonder if he would have changed his mind by this point. But I would just ask for some reactions from our panel to the comments of Mr. Kerman, and then we'll move on. But I thought it might be a sort of interesting gateway into our discussion. Anyone?
What is a load of rubbish? Absolute rubbish. Oh, sorry. I'll say that again.
Say it again.
I would consider that to be a good, really good load of rubbish. Just take one point at random, which you could take any you like. Opera as reality. What are we talking about? How can you criticize an opera because the people don't appear to be real? There are hundreds of wonderful operas where the people can't really be considered to be real, particularly from the Baroque period, like Handel, for instance. No, he was just making a case for... He was just being sort of... provocative, I suppose, is the word, really. He actually came to England as professor of music at Oxford University. But I don't think he stayed very long.
our Zalome, I see, has just arrived. Please come up.
I'm sorry. They separated us on purpose.
Hello. And this is our Salome, Lisa Lindstrom. So you're excused from the first question, but I'd still like to get more reactions from what Mr. Kerman had to say.
Yeah, I hadn't read that.
Isn't that awful?
It's awful. And, you know, more than sex, the opera for me is about longing and obsession and regret and jealousy, but very human emotions. When I got the assignment to direct the opera a few years ago, the first time, I was reading another book called The Rest is Noise.
Oh, yes.
Which is a brilliant book by Alex Ross, who's the music critic for The New Yorker. And the little epigram of the subtitle is Listening to the 20th Century. And it starts off in 1905 with the premiere of Salome. So it was an odd bit of synchronicity to get the assignment and to be reading about the opera. And it also made me think what you had to say, Stuart. It is very human. These are real people. We present them in a very formal context, a very hopefully visually exciting way, but we're responding to the emotion in the music. It's incredible music. It just rouses emotion. I was listening to the dance today at the orchestra rehearsal, and I was so moved. It makes you feel things a little bit more vividly, I feel like. And I'm also, I think, too, of this idea from Shakespeare that if we're performing a play or doing an opera, we're holding a mirror up to see ourselves reflected. With a piece like Salome, yes, we're doing that, but you might not like looking at what you see. You might not like what you see, but it's still pretty valid.
From the guys who were actually singing a couple of these roles, how did these statements strike you?
Well, I have to say, I've done, I don't know, Greer and I have done this opera a lot. We've done some very strange productions of this opera. This is incredibly tame compared to the ones, and I am loving this production, absolutely loving it. But I just think critics are going to be critics, and it doesn't matter when it is. It could be any time, and they criticize to criticize. Mm-hmm. It's one person's opinion. I don't read them anymore. Did you see your review? And I say, no, I didn't see it. And they say, oh, you have to read it. Somebody did that to me recently. I was doing a Pagliacci, and they said, you've got to read the review. It's fantastic. And I said, all right, let me see the review. And I said, oh, and I read the review, and it's a great review for the opera. But the reviewer had left my name out, and I was singing Canio, and he left my name out of the review. And I thought, but why did you tell me it was a great review? Well, it was a good review for the opera. I mean, you know, so. So, you know, reviewers are always going to be reviewers and critic. I mean, critics are, it's their one person's opinion. But yeah. I maybe it was shocking back in 19, you know.
Well, I find it strange that somebody of this caliber, supposedly, because he's got a big name in musical criticism. There you are.
I can tell you a lot of big names of a lot of big critics.
Yeah. But that he would be so dismissive of what I think is really a knock on the door of operatic style in the 20th century.
I think it's some of the most intense music I've ever.
It really is. It looks forward to Wozzeck.
Yeah.
You know, it's not all that far removed.
No. It's an incredible score. Yeah. Incredible.
Greer, do you have any reaction?
Well, I think if I would have the chance to meet him, my first question would be, who hurt you? because obviously his opinion of life in general seems to be shaded by some sort of unfortunate event in his life. That's the only thing that I can surmise about him, because it's just you cannot deny the genius of this work, and it's amazing. And Alan mentioned that we've been involved in some pretty strange productions, and the thing that always I have to laugh at when I'm in the middle of a strange production of Salome is that they're trying to make a shocking opera even more shocking, but in doing so, they completely remove the shock effect of the opera.
It doesn't work.
No, this poor gentleman, I hope he found some joy in his life before he met his
I think
end.
Perhaps his stepfather made him dance for him one
night.
Might have been difficult. Oh, did I say that? Strauss saw the play by Oscar Wilde in 1902 at the Kleines Theater. The production was by Max Reinhardt, so it must have been amazing. This was one of Reinhardt's very first directing gigs in Berlin. And it was in a very small theater. I'm sure it had a lot of impact. What do you think it was about the play that attracted Strauss in the first place?
Well, I'll go at that. I think if you look at the time period, the Berlin was bursting, Vienna was bursting, and it was a time where people were challenging the status quo, especially in Europe, not so much here.
Paris during that time.
And yes, and also Paris. And so, you know, you had Impressionism bursting forth, and I think it just was it was this very fresh view of certain things, and also at the same time, sort of questioning what we consider a Bible story. Wilde at one point very briefly flirted with being a priest, and that was gone very quickly. but there was still a certain amount of respect that he carried with him through that after that, and in sort of posing these questions and imposing points of view about sexuality, long before this, there was the Faun, you know, which was also this cause célèbre. So you had a time where people were pushing the limits, and I think that's what spoke to Strauss and musicians at the time was looking for something beyond what they learned, going beyond and finding a new language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maestro, the score of this piece seems to me, just listening to it on a surface level, to be very complex. Can you address that? Is it the many layers of instrumental sound and color, as well as leitmotifs? That's a very thickly paletted piece, it seems to me.
Oh, yes, indeed it is. difficult to specify exactly what constitutes a thick score. Just all you could say is that a lot of instruments are playing at the same time, all doing different things. It's very elaborate, very colourful, and it's one of those operas, rather like Mozart's Idomeneo, and indeed Tibbetts' Midsummer Marriage, that are literally bursting at the seams. Is the only way I can describe it. With musical invention. All set out with the singers and this enormous orchestra, which I'm afraid we have to cut down a little bit, but I don't think we lose any of the colour at all. I mean, people were incredibly... what's the word I'm looking for? The trouble is with old age, I keep forgetting the words I want. they were very sort of generous with the amount of performers they expected to use. Strauss, in this piece, if you add up his original requirements, there are 106 players. Mm. Now, there are not many pits that I can think of that can accommodate 106 players. It was first formed in Dresden, so I assumed that was possible. But he very quickly found he had to make do with somewhat less than his exorbitant demand of strings. We don't lose a lot from that, really, and I think it's we've stuffed the pit here absolutely full. You can't get another mouse in. and we play away, and it's very exciting indeed, wonderfully exciting. I just want to refer, I suppose, that which Kerman seemed to think was not a terribly good idea, this wonderful chord at the end, the big motive that Zalamy has. And there's a chord there that it's deliberately dissonant, which made up of two tonalities. And it actually sends you, it shakes your bones.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's an absolute bone shaker of a sound. And it does that to you, shoots through electricity. And it's quite one of the most dramatic moments I can think of. Something else.
That's lovely. I've been talking about the orchestra. Lisa, let's bring you into this, because it must be quite a challenge to sing over 106 musicians. What is that like, just physically, just from the standpoint of being one person standing on a stage?
Thank God. Making sound. I only have 80 this time, so that's okay. Maybe I'll have a better chance. It is quite a physical challenge, and one of the reasons why this is such a daunting role for so many singers, so many sopranos and baritones and tenors, because the size of the orchestra is quite large. Let's see, what can I say about that? It's like jumping off the high dive, you just sort of hope that you land in the middle of the water. And with the help of a brilliant conductor, which we do have, there's a partnership in keeping the balances together. So not everyone is playing at their heartfelt loudest all of the time, all night, because frankly it would kill us all, including the pit. It would kill me and probably the conductor as well. Mm-hmm.
Is it more thrilling, or is it a little daunting and scary?
No, it's absolutely thrilling. It's absolutely thrilling. It's the best thing ever. To have that wall of sound and get to catapult my voice over it, through it, around it somehow. Yeah, it's great. It's fantastic.
Now, this production emanated really from you, Sean. It was built, I guess, originally for Opera Theater St. Louis.
Yes.
And you and the designer, you had the concept, and you worked with a designer whose name was,
Bruno Schwengel.
To create it. Tell us a little bit about the production.
Bruno Schwengel has done the sets and costumes for this production. And when we were given the assignment, we got together and we started talking and dreaming. But we decided very early on we were not going to do a biblical, traditional kind of a setting. And because I was reading this book by Alex Ross, I was thinking a lot about the time when the opera premiered, 1905, what was going on in the world, the art world. And I looked at lots of paintings by Gustav Klimt and Egon Schiele, and I thought about the modern dancing, iconoclastic, fierce women who were making dances then, Isadora Duncan, Ruth St. Denis, Loie Fuller. So I got very turned on by what was going on in the art world in 1905, And we thought for a while, we set it in 1905, but we sort of opened it up to make it a little bit more sort of accessible and universal, and gave it what we've called a non-specific modern setting. There are certainly biblical references and touches, but it's a very formal kind of a piece. In addition to the art of the period, I looked at a lot of religious art. There's an incredible amount of paintings of Salome. In fact, Gustav Klimt made one 5 years after the premiere of the opera, which we were talking about. And very beautiful, romanticized, lush paintings. Sometimes she's naked. All the time she's with the head, you know. And I was looking at these paintings, and I have a thing for religious art. I'm kind of a collapsed Catholic, but I went to parochial school. But I love that kind, that brand of art, and I have a big religious kitsch art collection. So I was thinking about paintings in frames, golden frames, or a religious icon, or these beautiful paintings of Salome. And I thought, let's make a picture of Salome. Let's put the piece in a gold frame as if we're looking at beautiful paintings and pictures. And this idea about composition, perspective in painting. One of the devices I use is Yohanan is cuffed on his left wrist and ankle with thick black ropes. He's superhuman and powerful, and two soldiers hold him. And it makes a wonderful kind of visual effect with this kind of almost sort of the way, not to compare myself to the master, but the way a Da Vinci painting has that wonderful sense of perspective and horizon and all. So, you know, I come to opera directing from concert dance. I'm a modern dance choreographer, where I'm a music-driven guy. I'm responding to music, but I'm not telling stories. I'm not imitating scenes from life. I'm concerned with movement invention, musical visualization. How do I get the audience to see the music, hear it differently, by scribbling in space? So composition is very important to me, and the production is a series of pictures. We're moving through it, but hopefully it tickles the eye and your imagination in the way that the music can, and rouse emotion. And with this kind of formality, this kind of direct, heightened kind of physicality and pedestrianism, I hope you get a vivid kind of telling of the story. The opera's packed into 90 minutes. There's no intermission. It happens in real time, which is unusual in opera. Mm. It happens over the course of this evening at a party that Herod and Herodias are throwing. In our version, it's a party for Salome, but they've invited none of her friends. It's it's all the politicians and people they need favors from.
It's like growing up in the White House, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, this is your birthday party, but we're inviting the Supreme Court justices and the, yeah, right.
So the fact that it unfolds in real time, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's that hour and a half in that evening appealed to me as a choreographer, because when I make dances, it's not about before or in the future. It's a real-time kind of a thing. So, yeah, I wanted to give it a very vivid, heightened kind of sharp look, with the nod to art history and religious art.
That sounds exciting. I've just seen still photos of the production. Looking very much forward to actually experiencing it in the theater. It sounds like fun, number one.
Yeah.
But and with those references, it should be great.
Fun and scary, I hope.
Scary at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, as we were talking, it dawned on me last night we had a community conversation with John Marchari, who is the curator of European art at the San Diego Art Museum, and we talked about images of Salome through history, and right from the Renaissance on up to the time of Klimt. But I discovered nothing new, but a film that was made in 1923, yeah. The Nazimova, the sets and costumes designed by Rambova, which was not her name. She was a Hudnut heiress. Hudnut was the... Didn't they make cosmetics or something? And she patterned them after the Aubrey Beardsley drawings in the first edition of the play of Oscar Wilde. But what's interesting is at the end of the show, she goes to get the head. You see the platter. And you see her look at it. You never see the head.
And even when she puts the platter down on the ground, she tilts it towards her so that we in the audience don't see it. And then she takes her cape and pulls it over herself and the head. And you see a little bit of squirming underneath it. So you don't have a clue what's going on underneath that cope or that cape. And that's creepier than anything I've ever seen on the opera stage. But a question maybe generally, but I think specifically to you, Sean, what is it about the difference between doing it on stage and having a real 3D head, not made of marzipan, but made by our wonderful property developers and makers, artisans, and then on film being shy about showing it, but solving that reveal in a different way?
Yeah, we actually have Greer's head, believe it or not, and it's very disturbing because you look at it and it's Greer. We've been rehearsing with the head of a Canadian singer who I know. His name is Greg Dahl, and that's strange to me to see Greg's head being dragged around. But it is very disturbing. But this is live theater, and you get to see everything. And I think the difference between what they would do with a film where you're in close, it's a subtler kind of acting, it's different angles you're seeing. You know, we're lucky that we have Lise because she's such a compelling actress and is always thinking and making choices and playing in a way. There's a kind of rigor and intensity and focus and kind of an honesty in what she's doing. And I feel she's been a great collaborator because I say on the first day, we're not starting from scratch, everybody in the cast, but we are, in a sense, starting over. Because, you know, I come from the school of the dance is never done. You know, if you want to finish a piece of art, you make a pot or a painting and you hang it on the wall, you publish a novel. But when it's live theater, how do you speak an old language in a new way with a different accent every time you do it? So there's a very difficult scene where Salome is with that severed head. It's a very long time. I will tell you that it's a mini marathon. And Lise is an incredibly focused, technical, assured singer who can hunker down and just dig in and deliver it. But to answer your question, it's the collaboration with the actor who's inside in the middle of it, and then us, we're outside of it, trying to tell the story again vividly. And we take some risks, and it's not to shock or titillate, but it is just to show this strange girl. You know, we love Salome. There's an expression now you hear in pop culture, we're all victims of victims. Salome isn't a bad seed, at least not for me. She, you know, is a victim of her circumstances. Spoiled girl, sent off to school. She is learning about the power of her body as a 16-year-old young woman. She's always been fascinated with her power as a princess. There's lots of behavior in the show. We bow and we kneel to her. She's the princess. But all of a sudden, she has breasts and an ass and a vagina. And what do they do to Naraboth, the soldier who's smitten? He's the only one who really loves anyone in the piece. And her stepfather. Herod is not her father. Herod and Herodias had her real father murdered. So it's a stepfather, stepdaughter relationship. But I'll just say that the wheels are always turning. There's always different shadings and colorings. And I'm very grateful to have, you know, a collaborator who's an incredible singer, obviously, but also a fine actor.
Well, Lise, let's go with that. We had an interesting conversation in the podcast last week about the duet with Yochanaan and how she acts like a teenager. Would you describe that duet for the audience? I think that's just a fascinating moment in the piece that tells us so much about her.
Well, she hears his voice from the cistern first, and it's such a compelling sound. She's never heard anything like that. She wants to know who this guy is. And she learns from the soldiers that it's this guy who is the prophet, and everyone's terrified of him. That's why he's locked up in the cistern. And he has this beautiful voice that's riveting, which it truly is. Mm-hmm. And then she finagles a way to get him out of the cistern, and without giving too much of everything away, there he is in all of his white skin and this dark hair and this beautiful mouth. And she's so accustomed to getting everything that she asks for that when he rejects her requests so that for her to touch his body, touch his skin, have his skin, she says, well, I don't want your skin anyway. Just in a typical classic teenagery moment of, well, I didn't want that car anyway, Dad. It's a stupid car. And so she says, I don't want your body anyway. I want your hair. And then he says, you can't have my hair. And she said, well, I didn't want your hair anyway. I want your mouth. And then he said, absolutely not. And it shoves her over the edge because she's certainly never heard no three times in a row. Mm. And again, just to extrapolate a little bit on the background, in the sense that I feel a great amount of empathy for the character. You didn't ask me this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I feel a great amount of empathy for the character because she doesn't know that she's demented. She doesn't know that she's deluded. She doesn't know that she's spoiled. She doesn't know she's grown up in a household that is truly off mentally in lots of ways. She probably knows that her father was killed by her mother and stepfather, but maybe she thinks that that's just the way of the world. So it's always interesting to approach these characters not from a position of demonizing them and then trying to find the redeeming qualities, but from a position of them not knowing they're wrong. It's much more interesting.
Hmm. Alan and Greer, it's interesting that the two of you are paired down here at the end of the table, because I want to essentially ask you two sides of the same question. It seems to my ear that Yochanaan, or John the Baptist's musical language, is essentially very lyrical and very heroic at certain points. And Alan, as Herod,
<It's the opposite. laughs>
your music sounds exactly the opposite from that. And in fact, there are moments, I think particularly of the moment where Herodias takes his death ring off mm-hmm. of his finger, and then there is this cacophony in the orchestra, and things are just completely off kilter, and we don't know where we are harmonically.
But interestingly enough, there are moments where, in his little sanity, which is very few moments, that Herod has some beautiful lyrical moments.
Well, that's what I want to ask both of you.
So he does, all of a sudden, he'll come out of his craziness for mm-hmm. A few minutes at a time, and he has this, especially when it comes to Zalame. He's just fascinated with her right now, and he's wanting her, and he can't take his eyes off her, and he's trying to do everything he can, and there are moments that he's singing, trying to get her, says, I'll give you this. And I'll give you, I have this great wine. Mm-hmm. And those are lyrical lines that I sing to her. How about some fruit? I have a wonderful piece of fruit for you. And it's the moments where he has a screw loose, or more than one. Mm-hmm. And he sees black birds flying around his head, you know. And he'll be talking to somebody. It's almost like he's speaking in tongues, because he'll be talking normally. What was that? Or it's really cold. No, it's hot. No, it's cold. No, it's hot. No, he just, and then he'll go back. So what would you like? Is there something I can get you? I mean, which is the reason I absolutely love the role of Herod. It's one of my favorite roles to do because of this unsteadiness in his brain and being able to do this and go like that all the time. And
well,
the
I love that you
so great.
I love that you said that you also enjoy approaching the role lyrically.
Yes,
because there are a number of singers out there who simply don't. I mean, they just portray him as absolutely bonkers and crazy, and that the music is crazy, and they just approach it that way, and it is often barked.
Yeah.
But you sing it.
I sing it.
Which is wonderful, and it's very refreshing to hear from as crazy a character as Herod is.
He still has to keep that craziness, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Greer, what about Yochanaan? Do you find that you're speaking an almost totally different musical language than the people that surround you in this piece?
It can sound that way, but I mean, I find there is a relation in the whole piece with it. I take him as the symbol of normal. For you know, it's how we gauge how crazy everyone else is. And Strauss is brilliant to give us that musical language for Yochanaan. His is in most cases is this very very heroic and forthright music in the piece. And the rest of the people, he composes this very very frenetically filled orchestration for the rest of the characters, so that you do have a gauge of, you know, that this isn't completely everyone is crazy, you know, but in a sense that the Baptist is very single-minded about his purpose and about what people should be doing and how they should live. So in essence, he's also a member of this family of humans that are very single-minded about what they want. But his ends up in the normal range, whereas the rest of the cast are not. You know, it's
a very different role for you compared to the roles that you've sung for us.
Yes,
where there's all villains, and now you get to be the good guy. And
lastly,
sense.
The devil.
Yeah.
Yes. And now I'm on the other side of the fence. It's a wonderful role. It's a gift, and I consider this piece a masterwork. And it's always an honor and a privilege to get to do it, and to give the character, you know, some humanness, not just what we've been taught about him, and bring him to a more human scale, in this piece. And not take away any of his conviction, but he is a human, in essence. And the thing I love about being on the black robes is that, I don't know if this was a consideration of yours, but there is a candle. There's a saying: be a candle in the darkness. Mm-hmm. And in essence, he is sort of the flame at the end of the wick of this black line that's keeping him there.
Mm-hmm. Maestro. You are known as a specialist with the music of Benjamin Britten. You've spent a lot of time in your career conducting those scores. This is the first time that you've conducted Salome. Have you conducted other Strauss scores?
Yes, I worked on a lot of Strauss operas actually in my time. I've done quite a lot of things other than Britten. don't forget, I won't reel you with a list. but I've been going a long time.
Oh, no, I don't believe that. No, I guess what I'm curious is, did your conducting of Britten help prepare you in any way for the challenge of conducting Salome? Or did you just take it in stride?
I don't think it was...
And how on earth did you learn it? I guess.
Took a lot of work. I don't think there's a connection with these things. Britten actually was an admirer of Strauss, and those of us who know R. Peter Grimes will recognize that the offstage music in the third act is absolutely taken straight out of Rosenkavalier.
Mm-hmm.
Almost to the actual number of dances and the shape of the dances. It's quite extraordinary. He did study that piece while he was in hospital having glandular fever or something. He learned from it, certainly did. And Strauss was a great technician. He was a wonderful technician. And things, unfortunately, he states categorically at one time that because people tended to remonstrate with him because the orchestra was so large and it had a very tended to overwhelm the singers. And he said there is nothing that overwhelms the singers in this piece if the orchestra plays to the dynamic I have written. Well, of course, that's absolute rubbish. It simply is not true at all. And one does have to make adjustments. I'm afraid we have to change his dynamics a little bit in order just to allow a little bit of a voice through. But one thing I do beg of everybody is that you have to, if you're listening to singers in an opera house, everybody has a different capacity for hearing the words. Mm. No two people will give you the same thing. You can sit next to somebody where you've heard every word and they can say to you, I can't hear any words at all. I've actually seen this happen on so many occasions. So people vary in their capacity for this, so you can't really make a categorical judgment and say anything is specifically too loud or not. But we'll try and make it possible for you to hear as much as is conceivably possible.
I guess that's all one can do.
Indeed.
Is keep coaching and hoping that they won't follow what's written, but listen to your ears.
Well, the orchestral musicians play what's in their part, and so if you get them to change a forte to a piano, that will happen.
Hmm. Lise, I can't let this conversation go without asking about the dance. We have to talk about the dance. And I'm sure everybody has questions about the dance, but I'm going to only ask you one. It's a yes or no question. Isn't it wonderful that Strauss doesn't demand that you sing while you dance? That you get a little time off from singing.
I imagine if he had thought of it, he would have done it. He's truly evil.
But tell us about the dance. How do you approach that? I mean, especially if you don't have a dance background. What do you do? How do you
We
start?
Talked about this a little bit before, you and I, and it's always best if the dance is something organic from the production. In other words, if it's a direct relationship, it's a direct product of everything that's come before, of whatever backstory has been established with the production and the director and the musical staff, and so it's an organic transition.
So it doesn't feel like it's tacked on.
Yeah, I mean, there was
a set piece of some
in
sort.
A certain tradition, there was a time when singers, sopranos, would show up to an opera production of Salome and say, well, I have my dance. And regardless of whether it was appropriate to the production or not, that's the dance that happened. It also was a tradition that someone else did the dance. And boy, do I understand that. But all of that aside, this is truly a pinnacle experience for me, this production, because this dance is not only so inherently organic to the entire production, it's a fantastic dance. It's not cheesy in any way, which so many dances of Seven Veils can be, because one presumes there are seven veils layered on the poor soprano, and throughout the process of the dance, all seven of these veils get removed, and then down at the end, you're wondering how big that last veil is going to be. And
everybody's counting.
And everyone's counting. Yeah. They're like, was that five or was that four? I can't remember. And how in the buff is she going to be at the end, which is always a question, which I won't spoil the ending for
you now. And notice I didn't ask.
I know, I appreciate that.
Okay, good.
But this experience is so remarkable because we have Sean, because Sean comes from such a wealth of information of dance, music, punctuation with a body, and characterization. And he's able to provide a framework for Salome to do a dance. And then it just keeps growing and growing and growing, and we keep finding more to put inside this framework so that these relationships between Salome and Herod, Salome and Herodias, even Salome and John the Baptist become, it just gets richer and richer and richer. Mm. And it's, I think it's a beautiful dance. Mm, I hope I can do it well, but it's a beautiful dance. So I hope you all like it.
We will. Let's take some questions from the audience. Anyone? We've told you everything that you need to know about Salome. You have no questions. I'm sure somebody does.
Last question. last night you mentioned about the seven veils and that it doesn't have any biblical origin to it. And where did you find any more information about the origin of it?
No, I didn't, but that's a good question perhaps for Sean. What is the origin of the Dance of the Seven Veils specifically? I know it's a tradition because it's certainly not in the Bible story. Do you know where it comes from?
I don't, and I wasn't so interested in it because I knew I wanted to do something very theatrical, and I wanted to do Salome's party piece. You know, this you know, a kid gets up and sings a song or does a dance at a party. And sort of in our fantasy and Salome's backstory, we've talked about if she was a contemporary kid today, she'd be in her bedroom lip-syncing to Beyoncé records. Mm. And you know, singing them with the TV or whatever. We have seven different pieces of fabric which relate to these icons of modern dance. There's the first section is a riff on Ruth St. Denis's Sari dance. Ruth St. Denis at this time was going to Asia and bringing back what was then called Orientalism. And she would go there and watch the dances of different places and then appropriate or steal or take them back. So there's a sari dance. Loey Fuller was an American dancer and choreographer working in Paris with voluminous pieces of fabric. She was actually innovative in terms of lighting design. She was the first person to use colored light. She'd get colored bits of glass and put it in front of a gas lamp or light or something to throw color on the fabric. Doris Humphrey is famous for a dance called Soaring, where she uses a piece of silk that goes up and down. So the idea was that Salome would have been getting dance lessons from the best dance teachers available in Europe at the time. So it's seven different bits of fabric and, sort of riffing on these iconic iconic American women who in the day were revolutionary. Isadora Duncan running around in bare feet in a Grecian tunic with no bra was freaking people out at parties, you know, in Europe then. So I thought, you know, Salome is that kind of woman.
It must be a challenge to sing and act and direct a one-act opera that builds in suspense and emotion from the beginning to the end. How do you handle that in your various skills? Because it certainly must be a temptation to go a little bit too much at the beginning or in the middle and then not have much left. So
it points to me. Well, it's especially, it's funny you ask, because I come out with gangbusters. One of my entrance is very big when I come out. And it is very dangerous. You're absolutely right. It has to stay. It has to have levels. And it has to, yes, he comes out. He has this big thing. But it has to come. He's got to have these different levels of coming in and out of it. Otherwise, it's all just boom, 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 loud the whole time. And it doesn't work. So you are absolutely correct. And it is very difficult to do that. And I'm always saying to Sean, okay, am I doing too much? Tell me. Just tell me now. I can take it back. I can take it back. Because it's you, especially for the role of Herod, he's so out there. You want to just be out there all the time. And it's, I'm always trying, okay, tone it down. Tone, especially in what I call my jewel song. I have a little ariette, which I'm talking about all these jewels. And if I sang the whole thing, just blasting it loud, first of all, I couldn't get through it if I did that. But it's finding the colors in that, and I'm running around the stage like a maniac at the same time. So, but it is very difficult, and it's about different colors and different moments, and not letting it all being big all the time.
Yeah. No, I mean I think that's part of it is the genius of Strauss is that he leads you through it as well with how he's written it, and if you do a lot of the things that he suggests and bring the colors forward that about the text that you're speaking, then it sort of helps it helps you go through the scene and build it correctly.
I talk a lot about calibration. How are you calibrating that? It's sort of an interesting approach. I will tell you that The original production was in an 800-seat tiny theater with a thrust stage, which means the stage comes into the audience and there's audience on three sides. Very small orchestra pit, which meant the cistern couldn't go down. So I had a lot of challenges. Because it's a thrust stage, there's no curtain to go out. Strauss has not written an overture. The music starts, Narabov takes a breath, and we have liftoff. So one of the ways I solve that is we do what you'd call a dumb show or a pre-show, where it's exposition. I'm basically setting the scene for you. The soldiers come on, the slaves, it's the end of the party. Narabov comes out, he's looking at Salome through a door or into a window. So 10 minutes before the downbeat, we're setting it up. And I always think of it a little bit like we're in the lounge at the airport, and soon we'll be getting on the plane, and then the plane will be on the runway, and then the plane will take off. So it's a fine art of calibration and pacing, because as a director, I never want the audience to get ahead of me, right? I don't want you to get there before I do. And we sort of know the story, we know it's coming. So it's a fine dance, not to make a joke, but it's a fine dance of calibration.
One more quick question.
Sean, thanks for answering the question I'm just about to ask. I'm acquainted with the Opera Theater of St. Louis and the intimacy of the almost theater in the round. And I appreciated what you said earlier about setting up the gold frames around the artwork. But how and what are you doing so that this audience here in a 3,000-seat massive auditorium can avoid thinking about the proscenium and focus on what you're really doing in single frames of art, as it were, that moving art?
Yes. The set has basically doubled in size, believe it or not. It's much wider and deeper. And it's been in Montreal and San Francisco. For these large proscenium houses, I had to do a little bit more visual storytelling with the set. In St. Louis, we have what you call VOMs, vomitoriums, where the performers can come up under the audience, make an entrance onto the stage. So Vom right was always into the palace for me, and Vom left was where the slaves or the soldiers went to sleep or eat. So I had to go back to the designer and say, I need some visual information to help the audience. And he's designed this great sort of architectural tube that is coming in from stage right where the palace would be. We're sort of outside in a backyard, and just some simple slabs of what looked like concrete on stage left where the soldiers and slaves live or would go. I'm also aided by the fact that we have a beautiful big round white circle, a moon. The moon is very important in the piece. So we literally place the moon, big full moon, over the audience's head, but it's also on stage. So a big part of my job is telling the audience's eye where to go, where to look. And sometimes I need you to look at a couple of places at once. And I'll be honest with you, I've been criticized for this, coming with such a compositional, choreographic approach, using space in an architectural way. But I think it's what I can do best. And, tell you where to look. It's an opera and it's a theater, but I do think filmically, where is the camera and how close up do you want to be and how far back? And it's been a lesson for somebody who doesn't necessarily tell stories with their dance making. It's been a real tough lesson, but a satisfying one.
This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much all for being here. We look forward to Salome opening next week.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.